Really, if I could please, you can bring the drinks to your table. Okay, what are any available? You can sign up. Okay. Moment, without mentioning any name, I want to thank all the volunteers from our shul who've helped to all the logistical work that I caused them by coming up with all the programs and all their help, and I really appreciate it. The running around that they all have to do. Okay, Rabbi Bulko, I'm introducing for at least the third time this weekend. We'll start with first things first. Rabbi Bulko and his wife Naomi are the father of 5 children and 11 and a half grandchildren. But I assume when the other 2 children get married, they'll catch up a little bit. Rabbi Bulko has a PhD in psychology and is the founder and the editor of the Journal of Judaism and Psychology. Areas of medical ethics on many. He sits on the boards of hospitals and kidney foundations, etc., etc. He's been the rabbi of Congregation Machzikei Hadat in Ottawa since 1967. He's very involved in Congress and in many areas in the national Jewish community. He's a world traveler and speaker. He's speaking around the world. And without further ado, I want to introduce Rabbi Bulko, who I'm sure you'll immensely enjoy hearing.
Oh, wrong page. Are you okay there?
Smaller.
Thank you very much. Are we okay with this? Thank you very much, distinguished Mora D'Asra, Rabbi Jay Kelman. I begin by telling you that I'm not particularly delighted to follow a lamb to the altar. And you'll find out why. Let me firstly say b'chvod achsanya that you heard Rabbi Lam extol the virtues of Rabbi Jay and Ilana Kelman, and he's only been here today. I've been here since Friday, so you can imagine how I feel. And my dear wife, we're both immensely grateful to the Kelmans for the lovely house, the open heart, and those 3 little redheads. I am sure that you get lots of naches from seeing all the work that you've put in over the weekend, that so many people have come to the programs that you have put together, and I hope and pray that all of the things that you do should be blessed with hatzlacha as you try to infuse the shul here with a sense of achrayit to the greater Toronto community. Thank you to Dr. Elliot Malamed, who's been involved in putting this together. Thank you to the lovely congregation.
I also hope you don't mind if I extend a special thanks to all of the ex-Ottawanians who came here tonight. There are, of all of the people that are here tonight, 95% grew up in Ottawa. You don't realize it. But I know them all. I can see them. They're all over the place. By rights, in order to actually be as kind to Rabbi Lam as he was to me, I should quote from his books. I won't quote from his books, not because they're not deserving, but I will tell you a little bit about his books. This morning we had a chance, and Rabbi Lamin reminded me later on that we had already shared a program in Los Angeles a number of years ago. I think that what Rabbi Lam has done over the course of his life is something quite remarkable. He has located areas within the rabbinate that need desperately some guidance, and he has, in his own eloquent way, provided that guidance with his books. It started with The Jewish Way in Death and Mourning. It continued with Jewish Way in Love and Marriage. And now, over the course of the last little while, I'm not even speaking about the book on hope, which is a desperately needed book, but it took, you may not realize it, it took a lot of guts and courage for you to write a book on Geirut the way you did. Geirut is not a happy topic. It's not an easy topic. Lots of people would like to avoid it. It is an indispensable safer for Rabbonim that are Osek in this. And you have, I tell you, you saved me an immense amount of time. Because I, unfortunately, where I am, I get calls from people saying I want to become Jewish. So I tell them, go get the book by Rabbi Lam, Becoming a Jew. If you can get through that, call me back. And most people don't. But the people that do, they know what they're doing. And so I thank you immensely for all that you have done to make my Rabbanut easier and the Rabbanut of so many other individuals. And to hear you speak tonight with such passion about the present and the future of the Jewish community means that when you read those books, you're reading the books of an Ohev Yisrael par excellence. I've been going around for the last few days with this in my pocket. It's not a check. It's the questions that the committee has put together, and they're very small questions. However, from my drashah tonight, magnify them, because they are very big questions. Very big questions. You know that they asked the question, the perennial question, what's the difference between an optimist and a pessimist? The optimist believes that we are living in the best of all possible worlds. The pessimist is afraid that this indeed might be the case. We are here tonight because we are both optimistic and pessimistic. Optimistic because, as Rabbi Lam has spelled out so eloquently, the great achievements of Orthodox Judaism in North America, indeed over the entire world, that no one would have predicted. And those people who did predict the opposite are shaking their heads and they don't know how it happened. Some of them have even gone so far as to say, let's analyze this so we can sift out from orthodoxy what is their strength. We can bottle it, I kid you not, pill it, and give it over, let's say, to the conservative and reform movement so they can be successful like the Orthodox. And in case you don't believe me, read the books of some Jewish sociologists that are studying the North American situation. The fact that we were asked tonight to come to examine ourselves reminds me of a strategy that was adopted a little while ago by Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola went through a tremendous shakeup from top to bottom at a time that its sales were at the highest. And some of the individuals within the organization were approached to say, you know, why are you doing this now? Everything is going so well. And they said, the time to make changes is when things are going well, not when things are going terribly. It's when we have a hold on the reality in the way that we do, And we don't have to react out of fear. We don't have to be defensive. We don't have to feel as if we are on the verge of extinction. On the contrary, we're strong. And it's when we're strong that we can afford to do some of the things that we could not afford to do when we were not strong. What I'd like to do with you tonight is take the questions, and instead of, let's say, going around them, approach them directly. I will try to do the best I can. This is only one man's view on some of the issues that were raised. Let's take them one by one. The first question: what do you think is the number one challenge facing Orthodox Judaism, and how would you go about dealing with it? Rabbi Lam will be astounded, because as he was talking, my guts inside were saying, "Oy vey zmir." I'm going to land up saying the same thing as he did. Let me go backwards a little bit to a fascinating article that was written years ago by an American sociologist who was analyzing the marriage situation. And he was trying to figure out why it was that marriages were not working out. And his name is Richard Farson. He had a fascinating theory. It's called the failure of success. I don't know if you've ever heard of this theory. Have you ever heard of it? We've heard of the success of failure. No? Have you ever heard of the theory of the failure of success? It goes like this. He firmly believed that marriages were failing because they were succeeding. What was happening was that marriages were doing okay, they were doing well, people were okay in their marriages, but enough okay to want it to be even more okay. So the failures that were going on was because marriage was succeeding, let's say, in making life a little bit more enjoyable, but people who had a taste of this wanted a little bit more. And because of that, they were saying, well, I'm not going to get it from this spouse that I am stuck with because we are in neutral, so I want to leave. So I'm sure that this explains how very often you may have had situations where it looks like it's very good. What can be bad? The situation looks terrific, and yet people leave. That was his theory. Could we extrapolate this theory towards the situation with the Orthodox community? Namely, that we are succeeding, but that we may fall into the trap of the failure of success. Namely, that we are succeeding, but we want even more success than what we have. And the way that we're getting this success is, in fact, by becoming more stringent, more isolated, less involved with the greater community, and, in fact, less concerned about the greater community. This sounds strikingly similar to what Rabbi Lam said just a few moments ago. Let me share with you a little episode that I had that took place, must have been about 20 years ago. I went on a visit to Eretz Yisrael, one of my many, and I landed up in a shul in Tel Aviv, not far from the main street that was right off the beach. It was a Yekesh shul. I forget the name of it. It's Ichud Shivat Zion. That's the name of the shul. Very distinguished fellow there who was the Rabbi Ansbacher. And a nice fellow comes over to me. I was leading a group from the shul, so I didn't have any problems with where to stay. We were all in the hotel there. And he says to me, would you like to come for supper? And before I had a chance to say either yes or no to the invitation, he told me something very astounding. He says, But I want you to know when you come, this was in the year post-Shemitah, post-sabbatical. He says to me, you can come, but I want you to know that I'm makpid, I am scrupulous with regard to Shemitah. So I said, very good. But he said, you don't understand. What I mean to tell you is that I am scrupulous and insist on relying on the heter mechira. That is to say, on the sale that the rabbis make in order to use the stuff that is manufactured in Israel, that is produced in Israel. So I look at him somewhat quizzically because he could anticipate my reaction at my next question, favos, why is this so? And he said something which was quite amazing. He said, if everyone in Israel went outside of Israel and did not use the produce of Israel, Israel's economy would go bankrupt. And he says, my ahavat Yisrael, he says, even though I could find good reasons for being machmir, he says, I am machmir on ahavat Yisrael, on medinat Yisrael, and I insist on this in order to support Israel's economy. Now, how many of you listen to this and think that this guy is weird? Because if you do, then we're in trouble. Because this guy wasn't weird at all. What he was saying is, look, there's a small picture and there's a bigger picture. And I like to embrace the bigger picture. The bigger picture is, look, what's good for me and what's convenient for me is one thing. But even when I'm looking at the things, the decisions that I make that affect me, I have to be concerned about the totality. This type of mentality which says, my focus will be on Klal Yisrael. That is what is absolutely essential to Orthodox Judaism. We don't have to worry anymore about surviving. We don't have to worry anymore about being taken over by anybody. But as Rabbi Lam pointed out so eloquently, we have to worry about what's going to happen to those who are not yet Orthodox. And we have all sorts of kiruv that is going on. I think, in essence, the only way that this is going to change is if we change our fundamental attitude to conservative Reform Judaism and others. Because up until now, and I don't want to get into harangues about whether it was right or whether it was wrong. I could even make a case for, let's say, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when we were still, let's say, not on terra firma, that we had to espouse a no negotiations, we don't sit at the same table, whatever the case may be. I could perhaps even argue this, even if my guts tell me it wasn't the right decision. But I could argue it. I can't argue it now. I can't justify, at this point in time, as strong as we are, allowing the precious resources that we have as a Jewish people to go by the wayside when there are so many people that need us to show that we care for them. This means, yes, that the policy that we hear all the time, that if you talk with them, you will recognize them, well, I'm not sure that that's really a relevant argument anymore. Let's even assume that this is the case, that if we talk to them, we recognize them, we give them legitimacy. Let's assume that this is the case. But we have a more overriding issue that is at stake here, and that's the future of Klal Yisrael. Now, who is going to tell me that a principle such as this, dubious at best, is so overpowering and so overwhelming that it allows for us to sit by idly when an entire community is saying goodbye Judaism? I can't believe that this is a Torah way. So I am not arguing this as a form of compromise. that because of the fact that I know so many colleagues who are conservative and reform, that because of this, we should do this. I say that this is something that is lechatchila. This is an obligation that comes to us fundamentally from who we are, that we have to approach that community. Second question. We'll come back to this, by the way, because all of these questions are in a way interrelated. How should the Orthodox leadership shape and react to the tremendous changes in new sociological realities of the past 50 years? Well, I don't know what realities the questioners had in mind. But I wonder if it's the computer age. No problem. We have all of the Shailot and Shuvot, we have them on computer. If it's the Palm Pilot, well, just a few weeks ago when I was in Eretz Yisrael, I had an interesting experience. We had a group of rabbis that were there from Keren HaYesod for the Rabbinic Forum, and at Mincha time, one of the more frum fellows within the group was fiddling around with his Palm Pilot. So me, I walked over to him and I said, you know, in the middle of davening, Palm Pilot hat is pasach nicht. He shows me the Palm Pilot. He has mincha on the Palm Pilot. So how should we react to that sociological change? Ashrei mi shebo lekan v'tamudo biyado. He says, praiseworthy is the person who comes with a Talmud in his hands. Won't be a long time before in the palm of your hands you can have the entire Shas. Guaranteed. It'll be there. May even be there and I don't know about it. Those types of challenges I have no problem with. We can easily amalgamate all of those Gesundheit. All of those things.
No,
also now. Always. The question that arises is with other challenges. To those, for example, the new morality, which is the old immorality. did that come out right? Yes. A rate of divorce that is astounding, that we have, Baruch Hashem, reached the stage in America where a family of a husband, a wife, and children the initial husband, wife, and children living under one roof is a minority of the population. A minority of the population. So that's a tremendous sociological change. So I say to myself, okay, what are we going to do about this? I say, I want nothing to do with it. And our obligation as Orthodox members of the community, indeed any members of the community, doesn't make a difference what label you put upon it, is to say to that 1,000 times, no. I don't want it. I want nothing to do with it. Whatever it is that has brought you to this point in time, I will learn what not to do. At this stage where we hear all this onslaught of, whether it's psychobabble, I don't know what you want to call it, about the virtues of feelings and the legitimacy of leaving if you're not 100% in love and all this type of narishkeit, it's up to us, firstly, to be aware of the trends. It's up to us to understand why it is happening. And it's up to us to exercise the leadership to make sure that it does not happen within our communities. So as leaders, as members of a caring community, we have to make a differentiation between those parts of this new revolution, which are good, and those which are not. And I have enough confidence in our collective seichel that we'll be able to pick out the difference. The next one is a tormenting question. Why are increasing numbers of Orthodox children rejecting traditional Judaism and getting involved in substance abuse and aimlessness? If I told you what I thought is the short answer, you would probably get angry at me. I think for very simply because they see that abuse at home, and because that aimlessness characterizes their homes. So when you say, why are they aimless? Because their parents are aimless. Now, people are going to come to me and say, how can you say that? It's not true. We're not aimless. Any general answer has exceptions. Now, let's be clear about that. But the fact of the matter is that there is a tremendous amount of, not substance abuse, we're talking about verbal and physical abuse that characterizes religious homes. When I first dealt with an expert in this whole issue of abuse, and this expert told me something which is really stunning, which is across the board, so you shouldn't even feel badly about this in the Orthodox Jewish context. What she was telling me was that the incidence of abuse, generally speaking, is more likely to occur amongst religious families. Doesn't make a difference what religion. Doesn't make a difference what religion. Because there is a package that comes with more religiousness, generally speaking, not always, which includes authoritarianism, invoking the Bible or religious authority for whatever it is that you think it deserves to be in, and weighing down on whoever does not follow your dictates with the authority that you think is invested in you by divine right, which includes yelling, screaming, and hitting. One of the darkest secrets of our community is that we have this going on. In some guesstimates are that in 25% of Jewish homes we have this abuse. So tell me this is not an epidemic. And then once you know that, don't ask me, at least me anyway, why it is that you have children who are leaving. Who would want to stay? Who would want to stay in a family which is absent of love? In 1965, Rabbi Lamb's brother wrote a piece in which he said that the religious community, the families, many of them, the major problem is there's no love there. No love. 1965, if he would write this in the year 2000, he would have said the exact same thing. There are lots of families where there is love, and that's going okay. But there are lots of families where there's none, and where there is no love also, there's also aimlessness. There's a lots of doing things Jewish, but there's no being Jewish. And there's a tremendous distinction between the two. When Rabbi Lamb made this distinction before that, he quoted this lovely Meshech Chochmah. You know what this really was? A distinction between doing Jewish and being Jewish. Because the Avodah Zorah stuff, that's the doing stuff. But the Lashon Hara stuff and the Ahavat Yisrael stuff, that's the being. That's who you are. Gets to the very core. If there's no being Jewish, and there's no sense of Kedusha that emanates from a family, so I don't wonder why kids leave. You know what? Sometimes the question has to be, how come so few are leaving? Because if the epidemic is as bad as we hear, then there's going to be an avalanche coming out even more serious than what we've experienced up until now. Which leads to the next question. How can we enhance spiritual growth in our communities? Well, my dear colleague Rabbi Lam spoke about moderation. Let me quote a statement from a famous observer who said as follows. I don't know who it was. He said, living a life of moderation is fine as long as it is done in moderation. Let me share with you a story which will illustrate what I think has to be done within the community. This goes back to the time that our kids were young. Now, we live in real Golos. We live in Ottawa. Ottawa's real, real Golos, right? Galut, whatever you want to call it. So we felt that we had to compensate for the Galut that we were living in. It's a lovely place. I welcome all Torontonians to think of moving to Ottawa. It's a great place. And the 95% of Ottawanians who are here tonight will tell you it's a good place. Why they came here to Toronto, weiß ich nicht. What?
Weather.
All right. Anyway, we had... one day we went driving to New York, and we went into Borough Park, that mecca of Jewish salience, and we said, you know what, we have to buy some of that culture of Borough Park and bring it to Ottawa. So we bought something was the rage at that time. I don't know if it still is, because I don't keep track of this. Is Country Yossi. Anybody here remember Country Yossi?
And the Stiebelhoppers.
Huh?
And the
Stiebelhoppers, whatever. Oh, he's still in? Ach, weiß nicht. Country Yossi might be now be Country Yosef. Anyway, Country Yossi, we come home, and on Shabbat, at the Shabbat table, my kids, who were very, very young at the time, 6, 7 years old, so they're masichim lifi tumam, just spitting out the stuff. And they're listening to this, and my ears start to cringe. I say, are you sure that you have this right? What were they saying? There was this business of this duck who says, I can't imitate a duck. I mean, I'm basically. He says, did you do a mitzvah today? And the hero, Yossi, says, yes, I did a mitzvah today. What mitzvah was that? I kissed my Bobby. You kiss your Bobby? That's not a mitzvah. You kiss a mezuzah, that's a mitzvah. But you kiss your Bobby, that's not a mitzvah. That was part of the lyrics. Did you get this, by the way? So I said to my kids, are you sure this is right? Yeah, absolutely sure. I couldn't believe it. So Noch Shabbos, I made Havdalah, and the first time in my life, right after Havdalah, I went to the, what was it they used then? Record players. Remember record players? Anyway, I listened to it. The kids had the lyrics 1,000% right. So I was so angry, I wrote a letter to whoever it is that's behind Country Yossi, and I said, you are responsible for distorting Judaism in the worst way. You take a look in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, when it says that you have an obligation to honor your grandparents like you honor your parents. That's in Ramon Yoredeya. How do you honor your parents? Now, one of the nicest ways you honor your parents is by when you see them, you take them around and you give them a hug and you say, I love you. Because there's nothing that makes a parent feel as honored as that their children love them. So if the Ramon says that you should do it with your grandparents, that you should honor them, that means that you should embrace them and say, I love you. So I kissed my Bobby is a mitzvah. But where does it say anywhere that you have to kiss a mezuzah? It says in the Torah you have to put the mezuzah there. You want to show how important it is by kissing it? Good. But show me where there's a mitzvah to kiss a mezuzah. So you have a punkt verkehrt. But worse than the fact that you've made a mistake, you know what you've done? You've distorted Judaism. You've taken something which is a mechanistic act, and you've escalated this onto an art form of Judaic expression. You've taken something which is at the very core of what it means to be a human being, an appreciative person, someone who acknowledges their roots and embraces it, and you said, yeah, not a mitzvah. Do you know what it means? And when we ask ourselves, how can we infuse what we're doing with the spirit? It's basically to reinvestigate some of our priorities. This Country Yossi syndrome, where a mezuzah is a mitzvah and the kissing of a bobby is not a mitzvah, is paradigmatic of our escalating certain doing things onto such a level, but ignoring the being things. All the mitzvot, I recommend for you a sefer written by Rabbi Avraham Yellen on every single mitzvah that is related to Kas. We who never understand why it is that Noach found favor in God's eyes. So we are told in the rabbinic sources, because Noach was a calm guy. Noach from Nachat, right? Noach Motzochein. Why did God like Noach so much? Because he was a calm, cool guy. He never got angry. So does it mean, he also may mean he didn't have that much passion like Avraham Avinu. But there was a value inherent in this. Never got angry, not at his wife, not at his kids. He was an individual who had his values set out right. This didn't mean that nothing bothered him, but he never lost his cool. He could have been stern, he could have been strict at times, but we understand this as a Jewish value. Do we understand the expression of love to others and of caring and of empathy as being a value? These are things that we have lost, and I can guarantee you that I can justify it. In North America that we were living in, where there was an onslaught of all of the cultures that were trying to bombard us and tell us to assimilate, so we had to show to everybody else that we had the same props that they had, only better ones. So it was understandable that a lulav made it, or matzah made it, but things like Shavuot didn't make it. Shavuot didn't make it because there was nothing associated with Shavuot that said, ah, I can grasp it. I can show it off to somebody. What? A shear at night? Doesn't work. So the ingenious Jew of the 20th century invented something for Shavuot. It's called blintzes. So now we have this new thing. You ask anybody now about Shavuot, they says, yeah, this is the time we have blintzes. Cheese blintzes. Because they had to have something to show. But we can't go into that trap. Now that we are secure, we have to get into the dimension of the being Jewish. And being Jewish is beautiful. It's my next book, by the way. It's on the best kept secrets of Judaism. All of the mitzvot that you never even heard of that are essential to being a Jew. Next question. So far we've been very non-controversial. Can there be a constructive and even enriching dialogue and relationship with non-Orthodox denominations and leaders? Well, you know the famous story that they tell of the rabbi who after 120 years he was going up to heaven and he was waiting online to get in. The doctor came in, and the gatekeeper says, the doctor, come rein. So he said, you know what, this doctor probably saved a lot of lives. A lawyer came in, and he said, probably exonerated a lot of people who otherwise would have been convicted. Go in. Then an Eged bus driver comes. You know the story. Go right to the front. And the rabbi is frustrated. He says, why the Eged bus driver? I understand the doctor, the lawyer. He says, you know, rabbi, you gave sermons in shul. People fell asleep. By the time they woke up, any message you want, you're a nice guy, but no impact. This Eged bus driver used to take sharp curves around the mountain at 65 miles an hour. Everybody was saying the Shema. So, you know, Barash, we take a look at two different people, and we say, you know what? The rabbi belongs there, but the Eged bus driver, Vosater, you know, how does he get there? We don't understand. The upstairs in the Gemara, the best answer we ever got to what type of a malchut there is upstairs is olam hafuch. It's an upside-down world. What we think is right side up is over there upside down. That's what it is. But our focus, in terms of the ultimate hope, is always to make it upstairs. We don't want to sit in the grandstands. We want to sit in the box seats. We certainly don't want to be in the bleachers. The question that arises is what attitude should we take to the other denominations? Believe it or not, the Orthodox community, because of its strength, has had a tremendous impact. How do you explain the fact that, for example, within Reform in the United States, in their recent reinvestigation of where they were going, it's interesting, a reinvestigation of where they were going, they basically opened up the door to Orthodoxy. Against the protestations of the authentic reformists who said you can't have a Shulchan Aruch, because if we posit the idea that reform is ever evolving, how can you have a code of law? But they developed a code. You don't like the code, I don't recommend that you use it, but they have one. Then they said something quite amazing. He said, you know what? We invite the members of our community to choose from the tradition. This is from a Pittsburgh platform of years ago that had denied Kashrut, that had denied Shabbat, that had denied the primacy of Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden now saying to its chevra, choose, you can have it. Take some of it, all of it, whatever you want. Basically opening the door to orthodoxy. Now, you don't know about this, but we follow this very carefully. It never would have happened had there not been a strong orthodoxy. So then you say to me, okay, Rabbi, but you're destroying your argument. Because here you see you have the reform that are going towards the orthodox, and it happened because we didn't talk to them. Narishkeit. It happened because we talked to them. But maybe not openly. And the question that we have to ask ourselves is, how much more would have happened had we talked to them? Do you in your right mind think that in the 1980s they would have come up with patrilineal descent if there would have been a dialogue with the Orthodox community? So you say to me, so what's the big deal? I say, it's a big deal. Because the major dangers that we have to our future stem from patrilineal stuff, from the failure to get the reform movement to adopt the necessity for a get after the dissolution of a marriage. I have a few of my dear rabbinic colleagues who have put their neck on the chopping block, and through their connections with reform colleagues have convinced them that whenever someone in their congregation gets divorced, they should go to rabbinical court for a get. It would not happen if they didn't talk to them. So, you know, when you say that, okay, we don't want to have an open dialogue. Folk me again with the open dialogue. Have a closed dialogue. Talk to them on the phone. Be involved with them. Tell them that, you know, we care about you. It doesn't have to be done at a meeting where newspaper people are there. But the fact of the matter is that when it doesn't happen that way, it doesn't happen the other way either. And I can't see the justification for doing this when the stakes are so high. And the major dangers, again, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I would go dramatically radical and say, look, I will talk with you, do anything. I just want from you two things. Get out of the G's. Forget about Giyur and forget about Gittin. Leave those things alone. Go for Gittin to a rabbinical court, and go for Geirut to something like what it's starting in Eretz Yisrael. Have something like that. Is it azoy schlecht? When Rabbi Lam says before, what we have to do is stretch the halacha to the limit, and you say to me, well, what's the justification for it? Chabur atzabim afrayim hanach lahem, which is quoted not only in Rashi, in the Chumash, but in places like Sefer HaCharedim, can you believe it? Where it says, when Jews worship Avodah Zarah, but they are at peace with each other, the heavenly dictates of judgment have no power over them. That's a Jewish value. What happened to it? Why is it that even amongst Orthodox Jews there is so much fragmentation? What can be done about it? It reminds me of the famous line from Rodney Dangerfield. He spoke about his marriage. He said, my wife and I, we have breakfast at separate times. We sleep in different bedrooms. We go on separate vacations. We do everything we can to keep our marriage together. In some perverse way, argumentation has some benefits, up to a point. Indifference comes from no difference. And we wouldn't want to be indifferent.